heard his story several times, but the workshop that's ahead of us tomorrow, I've heard him share, and it's phenomenal. And Ed's phenomenal. And I would like to share with you my very special friend, Ed.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ed.
Want me to turn this off so you don't have the feedback? Better? Ding hao, she she ni. Just wanted you to know I could speak other languages as well. I am delighted to be here. Did I tell you that I'm an alcoholic, and but for the grace of God and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and God and sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th of 1971, and for that I'm really grateful. I was old when I got here. I've just gotten young and prettier since I've stayed. I am delighted to be here. I want to thank my dear friend Joyce for inviting me up. We were going to do this a year ago and couldn't make it happen, so we're doing it tonight. And the one thing I love about my life is everywhere I go, I'm delighted I'm there. I don't know about you, but my life before is I always wanted to be some other place, some other person, and some other time, please. You know. And today and tonight, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Tomorrow we're going to do a workshop, and I hope you'll be here for that. I'm not up here professing to be an expert in any sense of the word on Alcoholics Anonymous or the Big Book or the 12 and 12 or any other books. What I'm here to, not that there aren't some people that do wonderful jobs with that. I'm up here to, and will be here this weekend to tell you what I've experienced, my experience, strength, and hope with the 12 steps. The 12 steps where it's concerned in my life, and that's every area. And that's one of the big areas I want to approach tomorrow. I find it increasingly amazing how people think after they stop drinking or after their spouse gets sober, well, that's it. No, that's just the beginning. At least that's my experience. And I'm one of those that believe that if you don't work this program in every area of your life, whatever area of your life you're not working it in, that's your next program. At least that's been my experience and the people around me. I was raised in Davenport, Iowa, but I drank for some other reasons too. There was a no. Davenport's a wonderful. In fact, when I left yesterday afternoon at 12 o'clock, it was 15 below zero with a wind chill of 35. And I love coming here where it's swimming weather. I'll tell you that. You know, it's just really great. But I hated Davenport for years. I hated where I was born for years, but you see, I hated pretty much everything, or had a strong dislike, if you will. Because I started doing something when I was a kid that if I'm not very careful, I can do today, and I promise you some people will do it this weekend. It's just the way we are, some of us. And I could walk into a room with 300 people, 299 could turn around to me and say, Ed, you're the best. We love you. And one person could go, what a jerk. Guess who I remembered? Forever. Didn't even remember the 299. Didn't remember all the goodness was in my life. But by God, I could bring up the negative stuff. I could bring up the reason to be resentful. I could bring up the reason to be honest, and that's before I even had a drink. By the time I was 6, I needed a drink, and I had one. You know? My father was a drinker. There was a lot of drinking in my house, so I don't know when I took my first drink because Dad always gave me sips of beer and things like that, and he used to think it was funny to get me drunk. But I'll tell you what I did find out real quickly on is that a few drinks made it so things didn't matter so much. I wasn't as scared as the other kids in school or afraid of them when they wanted to fight. And I've always been big for my age. I guess I still am. But, you know, when you're the big guy, everybody seems to want to try you on, especially guys this tall. I don't know what that's about. But I still got scars on my knees from those guys in the boy. Hey, big fella. You know. But I found out that if I had a few drinks, I wasn't afraid anymore. I really didn't care. And alcohol for me kicked in my I don't care button. And the way I looked at the world, it was necessary for me not to care. I said for a long time, I don't care. I don't care. People would say to me, look what you're doing to your mother. I don't care. Eventually it was, look what you're doing to that ex-wife and that baby. I don't care. And it was the biggest lie ever told. One of the things I know today and I'm pleased about today more than anything else in my life is I care more than I ever dreamed possible. But you've taught me how to. And that's what I didn't know. That's what I didn't know. Because when I'd get my feelings hurt or when I'd get sad or, all I knew is to drink. And when you start drinking in an early age, it's funny, they always say when you start drinking and then when you get sober, when you start drinking, your maturity stops. And when you get sober, you catch up. Well, I got here when I was 27 or 20 years old. I'm now 37 years sober, so I figure I'm even, you know. So look what you got to look forward to. Some of you got to live to be 112, but you can do it. You can do it. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 10. I've got a brother in Newberry, South Carolina, that 3 days ago celebrated 46 years of continuous sobriety. You know, I'm one of those that you can't tell me this don't work. You just can't tell me his wife's been in Al-Anon for 44 years. You know, please don't bother telling me it don't work. There's one difference, if you're working it. That's what I found out. There's people that work it, and then there's people that they're far too different of cases, and it really don't apply to them. More of that today than ever before, and it's terrifying. We'll get to that tomorrow when we go through the steps. I remember going to that meeting, and there was some old guy up here, about 20, 25, you know. He's going, my name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, good for you, Fred, you know. I thought, if I ever get old and burn out, I'll be here too. I didn't know I was a prophet at that point. It took a few years. But I remember going to AA, and I always hear people say, nobody ever lied to me in AA. Well, they lied to me. Right out of the gate, they lied to me. They said, you keep drinking and do what you're doing, you're going to die. And I thought, excellent. Where do I sign up? Promise me? Because the one thing I didn't want to do anymore is live. I didn't want to see that look on my mother's eyes. I didn't want to break any more hearts when I promised with everything in me that I wouldn't do it again. And here I am doing it again. That they're coming to bail me out one more time or pulling me out of that mangled wreck. Or my mother sitting outside the emergency room while they pumped my stomach because I OD'd one more time. They said, you keep doing that, you're going to die. And I thought, where do I sign up? I don't mind dying today, but I promise you for a whole different reason. So dying didn't scare me. But I'll tell you what eventually got to me is the thought that I might live a long time feeling the same way I was feeling. I come into AA January 5th, 1971, 20 years old, going on 104. I was an old, old man. And people don't seem to understand that. And I used to get a lot of that stuff. You don't hear it anymore, and I'm real grateful for that. People say, well, I spilled more than you ever drank. And I'm so glad you got it when you were so young. You know, if we were cancer survivors, and a 19-year-old was in this hospital with cancer, would we really go into the room and say, so glad you got it so young? No. The disease is the disease. The perception of age has something to do with it is ridiculous, just the same as with cancer. The preoccupation, because they've done it for X amount of times, means X amount of disease, is silly at best. And deadly a lot of times, because I've seen people that had more of the disease than the old-timers that run them out of the meeting. And they never come back. I was fortunate, though. A few of those said that, but I'd started breaking the 299 to 1. There was a few that said that there were more that said, come on back, Ed. Come on back. I remember that night I was in a car wreck, and it was like every other weekend, I seemed to be in a car wreck. And I had like deja vu today, come to think about it. And with the inside joke is we were driving down the road today and somebody rear-ended us, so if I act a little stiff, that's why. And I was always in a car wreck. I don't joke about that too much anymore. You know, it's funny how you change. You change when you get sober. I used to think it was funny to drink and drive and drunk, and I remember I was about, 15 years sober maybe. And I had taken a girl I was dating to her class reunion. It was her 20th class reunion or something like that, and I dropped her off. And I'm headed home, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and there's just coming up to the apartment there where I lived, and there's a silver Honda, and all the doors open up, and kids get out, and I thought, oh, good, Chinese fire drill. That's what I want. For those of you who don't know what a Chinese fire drill out, that's whenever all the kids open the doors and run around the car 2-3 times and jump back in and take off. That's what I thought was going on, and as I pulled up, I saw a motorcycle laying on its side there, and I saw a body laying next to it. And I stopped the vehicle, and I told him, put my car in park, and I said, call 911, get some help. And I went over, and I turned off the motorcycle, shut off the gas line and turned off the key, and I went over to this young lady that was laying there. And I said a selfish prayer. I said, God, don't let her stop breathing, because I could see her shirt up was over her head, but I knew she had a bad head injury. And I prayed with her, and she stopped breathing, and I pulled that shirt down, and I got her breathing again, and I brought her back about 3 times. And then about 5 minutes before the paramedics got there, I lost her. And there's a young, tall young man behind me, 20 or 22 maybe, saying, I only had 2 drinks. I'm not drunk. I only had 2 drinks. And all I could say to him was, it is in your best interest to stay away from me at this point. It's in your best interest. I've had 2 brothers killed by drunk drivers. Do you think that would have done it? You know? But it was little Tony, 20-year-old Tony, dying in my arms. I said, you know what? That just ain't funny. Just ain't funny. And I'm not against laughter. We're going to have a lot of laughter this weekend. We're going to have a laughter that's a healing laughter instead of a hideous laughter over hideous stuff that happens. I was in that car wreck laying in the middle of the street. I also, I don't think I told you, I picked up another little a hobby. I was a cop fighter. And that's not a good thing to do. If you're a cop fighter in the room, I want to tell you there's always more of them. I'll just tell you that. And if that don't mean anything to you, there's nothing more I can tell you, you know, because you're going to do it anyway. But I had a resentment toward the police for years. When I was 13, they arrested me for possession of a sawed-off shotgun, a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun. It was 14 inches long, and I liked that thing because when I pulled it out, I was in charge automatically. Talk about a higher power, you know, and the police were going to help me because I had an older brother that was going in and out of prison already then, and they were going to help teach me a lesson, so they threw me in the hole for 6 hours. And they taught me a lesson. I was a cop fighter from that day on. And I still kind of had those feelings in the back. They diminished a great deal when I got sober because, yeah, I can't remain sober if I'm going to keep that kind of animosity. But I'll tell you when it really changed for me is last April 13th, when I went out to Los Angeles, California, and badged my 24-year-old son as a new Los Angeles County Deputy Sheriff. And I realized as I put that badge on him, he's going to have to be around people who behave like I did. And I only made one request of him. And he does it every day. And I said, buddy, every day when you put on that body armor, put on the armor of God, would you do that for me? He said, sure, Dad. Sure, I will. It's funny how when we look at things from different perspectives, it's funny how we can be so judgmental and judge people. I remember one time I was in a meeting in Beverly Hills, and there was a woman there. It was a big meeting on Friday nights where all the stars hang out, and I figured, well, I found home. And there was this woman got up. It was 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. This woman got up and talked, and she started weeping because her head maid quit. And there would have been a time when I would have went, jeez, give me a break. But you taught me to listen. And I continued to listen, and what I heard was, the next night she was having a major party in Beverly Hills. 800 people were coming, and the head maid was in charge of everything. She just left. what I used to scoff at, I now understood. And I learned that here. And I learned that, and I remember that when I listen to people talk in AA. I hear some people say sometimes, well, geez, he should act better than that. He's 25 years sober. Well, you don't know how bad he used to be. He may be, he's probably a walking miracle right now. Leave him alone. But to listen to the whole story and to listen to the dis-ease in the individual, and I'm sure glad I did then. They rolled me up, they took me up and put me in the hospital. Oh, the police were calling me all kinds of names, and as they covered me up and said, the car's probably stolen, that's mutum, he's the scum of the earth, don't even cover the SOB, da-da-da, and he kept on and kept on. And I didn't argue, I didn't fight. The fight was gone. They took me up to the hospital. Rolled me past a nurse, and the nurse said, Ed, do you want me to call AA? And I went, might as well. Now, us old-timers want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days, you know? We'll get into more AA sayings tomorrow, but the one that makes me crazy is, and I walked through that door, and I was home. You know, I've been doing this a little over 37 years, continuously sober. And I've never seen anybody walk in and go, I'm home. They come in just like we do. Jesus, come to this. You know. But that nurse asked me if I wanted to call wanted me to call AA, and I said, might as well. Now, I was a wine connoisseur. You know, it had to be a reasonable date, June or July, you know. Good month. And I liked the gold caps. Those were good. And I liked to mix it with everything I could put my hands on. Now, I believe in singleness of purpose, and I will stick with singleness of purpose, but I'm going to tell you this. One thing you never heard come out of my mouth is, oh, what'll this do to you? What you heard is, got any more? How about them purple ones? They're pretty. And I would ingest anything that would keep me away from feeling. My main mission was not to feel anything. People used to think I was funny, being funny. I wasn't being funny. They said, man, were you loaded last night? I said, was I moving? And they said, yeah. And I said, then I wasn't loaded. They thought I was kidding. It was the truth. That's where I wanted to be, where nothing could touch me. Well, if you drink enough of that wine, it gives you a little gift called the dry heaves. And, oh, those are fun. Those are fun. And if none of you know what those are, I hope you never figure them out. But they're kind of, when you get the dry heaves, you can't, and it kind of comes from your toes. And you just, you know, and you always have a cough at the end. A little slobber comes down. Your face shakes and you sweat. Just about the time you think it's over with, here comes another one. And just about the time that's over, you taste your toenails. And then you know, well, it's just about over now, you know. And you do your little Thorazine shuffle back to bed. You just put your face on those nice cool sheets and try to cool down a little bit. And in come Hap from AA. And he was smiling. They called him Hap, short for happy. Now that's somebody you want to see right after a good case of the dry heaves. Happy. He said, hi, Ed, I'm from AA. And I thought, get out of my room. I didn't say that, thank you, God. He said, Ed, we don't drink and we don't use one day at a time. And I said, I don't know why I got honest. I said, I can't make it a day. Can't make it a whole day. Can't. And he said, Ed, all you have to do is try. And that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this is try. Sometimes greatly, sometimes barely, but I've tried. What have I tried to do? To do it a little better than I did it yesterday. Be a little closer to God than I was yesterday. Be a little better father than I was yesterday. Better spouse, better worker. I just try to do it better today than I did it yesterday. And that's held me in good stead. I collected a lot of those ones I told you about when I was a kid, about police and about life and about church and about spiritual folks that all had thin blue lips and talk like this. I remember those ministers in my my home church, you go, you're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell. And I used to think, how does he know? Well, he knew me for a while. He's probably correct at that point. But I just remembered that I didn't like them, and all he did is threaten me. Everything else they said, wasted material. Because I had my case for being a victim. I had my case for being angry. I had my case for whatever it was for me to be the center of attention, either in a positive way, but mostly in a negative way. Most of all, it would excuse me to keep doing what I was doing, because if you've been through what I've been through, baby, don't talk to me. I remember I was through a series of incidents and misunderstandings, I was committed to an insane asylum. And I didn't have any clothes. And I went into this social worker, and I remember she had huge diamond earrings on. And she was very nice, I'm sure. But I'm in there trying to get some pants and underwear and a shirt. And she says to me, "I know how you feel." Oh, wrong thing. Wrong thing to say. I helped her. I said, "You have no idea how it feels. How many times have you gone in to beg for clothes, lady?" She quit the next day. Seems she returned to school. That's the grace of talking to people who've had some actual difficulties in life and came through them standing up. I sat in the gatehouse today. If that conversation had not taken place, we wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. One drunk talking to another, one broken person talking to another broken person, however you want to look at it. If it hadn't taken place. That's what I wrote. They have a little letter in the library. They snuck us in today. Joyce was nice enough to get somebody to... It's closed season, and they opened it up so I could go in and sit. We sat in the library where Dr. Bob and Bill talked, and they have little things that you write. I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but I said if the conversation hadn't taken place in this room in 1935, my kids would not be alive. I would not be sober. And sitting in this room today, I realize that my job is to simply to carry on the conversation. That's what I'm called to do. Carry on the conversation. Bob ran into somebody who knew exactly what he was talking about. Wasn't preaching at him, was sharing with him. And man, I love that. I love that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had a lot of ones about God, like I told you, and they started real young. I remember when I was 10 years old, I had a cousin that if anybody was close to God, it was Linda. She was perfect. Hair was right, honor roll, magna, this and that, just everything, you know. I couldn't stand her. And, because I was always comparing my insides to her outsides, and she was always superior. So those are people you hate. They're either superior or inferior. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started working through the 12 steps, and I became equal. It's an amazing thing. But Linda was walking across the street and got hit by a truck and killed. And I remember going to the funeral, and the people were in there going, "God must have wanted an angel." And I said, "So he hit you with the truck. I'll pass. Thank you very much." You know, thinking about it, I'd still pass, actually. But that's what I thought. God's being a little moody, wants to bring you, come on down, you know. And then I got to blaming God, the God of my lack of understanding, for a lot of things that were going on in life. If there's a God, why are there starving children in the world? If there's a God, why is cancer so rampant? If there's a God, why have I gone hungry? If there's a God, why do people have to bring us Christmas dinners? If there's a God, why can't Dad work? You know? Those are the kind of jams I fell into, and there was an echo voice when I'd answer why that happened, ask why that happened, but there wasn't when I came to AA, and I'm real grateful for that. So when I got to AA, one of the things they said was, if you're going to stay sober on a permanent basis, you need to have a relationship with God. And I thought, man, I'm out of luck there. You know, I'd burnt that bridge. I knew that. I'd burnt that bridge, and then they give me one of the keys to the kingdom. They said, why don't you make up a God of your very own. And I went, really? You can do that? And they said, yeah. So I thought long and hard about it. And I came back next week and I said, well, you know what? I got a God that's kind and loving and forgiving. How do you like them apples? They didn't seem to mind. That was 180 degrees from anything I'd ever entertained about my perception of God. I know you guys aren't this way, but there was a guy in church, I remember. He always had thin blue lips. They always do. Sat up front looking holier than thou every week. And I looked at him one Sunday and I said, you know, he was having a lot more fun in the bar last night. And I don't know who that grump is he's sitting with, but the gal seemed to be a lot more fun too. And I think, what a hypocrite. What a hypocrite. Now, I know you wouldn't do this, but I didn't only judge that guy and his wife or that pew or that church. I have a broad brush. I judged entire organized religion by my little narrow mind. That's the way they all are. And you know what? It's the truth. You could have hooked me up to a lie detector and it would have said true. Because once I buy it, it's nothing to lay it on you, you know. And I'm sober a few months and Father Tom comes up to me. Thin blue lips. Said, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And I had the honesty part of the program. At about 3 months, you get honesty. At about 6 months, you get a little tact to go with it. I'd suggest you wait. Just my 2 cents. But Father Tom said, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And I told him, I said, because it's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. Felt pretty good about telling him, too. And he looked at me and said, well, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. I punished him. Didn't talk to him for 2-3 months, you know. Tell me the truth, I won't talk to you. That'll do. That'll teach you. And, God. Man. Talks in the big book about being reborn. Means new life. New life. Not new parts. New life. And that's what you gave me with my faith. Not reborn, but born for the first time in my life. I had a chance to actually come to something I could understand. I always got lost in how you understood God rather than working on how I understood God. That's what's important. And this weekend, how I understand God isn't important at all. It's how you understand God. That's what's important. Because that's what's going to count for you. You know, you can't stay sober on my faith. Well, sometimes you can. When terrible things happen, and AA and Al-Anon surrounds you, and the other 12-step programs surround you and carry you through, sometimes you can. But it says clearly in the blue text that there will be a time when there will be no sufficient defense against that first drink. It must come from a power greater than yourself. And that has surely been my experience. And you better have one you can believe in. Because if you don't, here's what happens. I was sober a little over a year, and my dad asked me to come home for dinner. Now, that might not be strange to you guys, but the only time the old man invited me for dinner is when I had a lecture coming and I was in trouble. And I really didn't want to go, but the guys in AA and that said, you need to... If your family life's going to change, it's got to begin with you. Don't use excuses while they're still sick. You bring your program in and apply it, regardless of what they do. So I suited up and I went there and I went to dinner, and about halfway through dinner, Dad said, boy, and I thought, oh, here it comes. I said, yeah, Pop. He said, just want to tell you I'm proud of you. Now, that may not mean much to you guys. And if you're new or if you're used, in these programs, they're going to tell you that miracles happen, and I'm here to tell you that that's exactly my experience. But I also got to tell you that my old man telling me he was proud of me never made my list of miracles. I mean, there's just some things that are impossible to happen. I hated that old man because he tried to make me a better kid. You know, for years in AA, I used to tell people how I was abused. how Dad would pull out that engineer belt, or he'd come from a school where he used his fists. And I'd always tell people how I was abused and how my mother'd whip me with those hangers straightened out, which she did once, and how violent and how mean they were. And a few years ago, you know, I got to thinking, I don't ever remember walking in that house and them just grabbing me and whipping me. Maybe something happened prior to that. And here's what happened. I would push and push and push and push, and they would break. And then I'd go, see? You see, I wasn't a person who experienced child abuse. I was a parent abuser. And I abused him every chance I could. And I didn't even know it. Had no idea. So much easier to blame them. So much easier. And the old man told me he was proud of me that night. And I'll tell you, when I walked in there that night, if you had asked me if I cared what my old man thought about me and had me hooked to a lie detector, I would have said no and it would have said true. I am so grateful. Now, you know, I want to tell you something. Just because that's been my experience, I'm not saying other people weren't abused. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying in my case and in my experience, I was totally wrong. But that lie detector, I was grateful I was so wrong about that. And you know what? So many other things I found in this journey of spiritual sobriety. I hear a lot of people say to me, you know, I don't get the spiritual part. And I said, what part? The text I read is all spiritual. There is no spiritual part. I was intellectually sober for a long time, and crazy, I might add. And crazy. By God, nobody's going to tell me anything. You know, I walked out of the house that night and went to a meeting after that dinner with Dad, and Mom called me a little while later, and I was crying and hysterical, and said, Ed, come home quick. And I said, why? What's wrong? She said, Dad went across the street to get himself a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and now they're carrying bodies out, and there's policemen everywhere. Come home. And I came home. It was one of those nights. I know you get them here, the ice storms, where you got a quarter-inch ice over everything, and it's just a mess. Took me a while to get home, and I pulled outside, up to that bar outside, and there were more policemen there than I'd ever seen. There were people from departments of law enforcement that I didn't even know existed. They were everywhere, and it's funny how those cops had shaped up that year I was sober, you know? Share a little with you. If you stop calling them names, they usually stop calling you names, and you don't swing at them, they usually don't swing at you. Just a few things I'd pass on. In that first year I was sober, I did a lot of work in the courts. You see, at that time we had a relationship with the courts that if somebody had a drug or an alcohol problem, they'd just give them to us. And we'd keep them for 30 days and come back and tell Judge Steffens how they were doing. They were either trying or they weren't. And that's what their sentence was based on. I mean, people were staying sober right and left. I tell you that story because the police saw me going in and out of there all the time. They could not believe I was sober, and I don't believe would have believed I was sober if they hadn't seen me almost every day, because I didn't think I was going to stay sober. I was certain they didn't think I was going to stay sober. And I just gained an amazing respect for law enforcement. One incident in particular was, there was a lot of racial tension in this one incident after a couple years. That year I was sober, I was down there, and something was going on. I don't remember what it was, but I remember two undercover cops with submachine guns in boxes, and they were dressed like janitors. And I'm going, huh? And the one guy showed me his Uzi, and I went, Uzi? And I'm walking into the court, and this officer's walking by this group of guys, and one of the guys went, spit right on him. And this cop stopped, and he took a breath, and he kept walking. My admiration. I did not have the integrity and the courage to do that. He knew that if something happened, somebody'd get hurt bad. Somehow, instinctively, I knew what he was teaching me. And I watched, and I listened. and I heard, and I'd never had any problem with law enforcement since then. So that night when I went to the Shamrock Tavern after my mother called me and all those policemen were there, I walked in and one of the officers said, "Ed, what are you doing here?" And I said, "My dad was in here." He said, "Oh my God, Ed." And I said, "Why? What's going on?" He said, "Ed, all we can tell you is somebody came in here and shot everybody." And I looked down the bar and I saw a pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up in it. And I knew, but I didn't want to know. I'd just been with you a year. 20 years of being on the streets and even in the score. All I could think of is live and let live. And I did one of the most amazing things I'd ever witnessed me do. I turned to a policeman who used to be my arch enemy and I said, "Please tell me what to do here. I don't know what to do." He said, "Ed, go up to the hospital." I said, "Not everybody's dead. Go up to the hospital. See if your dad's up there." And I said, "Okay." And I got in my car and I went up to the hospital and there was an officer up there who hadn't forgotten my past. And he was not kind. He called me some names and told me to get out of there or he'd have me arrested for obstructing justice. And another miracle in my journey in recovery, I just said okay and I left. A year and a half before that, they would have been looking for a new lieutenant because you don't talk to me that way and stay standing. Ain't messing with punk. But I said okay and I left. I went home and I called the one person you could have never convinced me I would ever call ever. And he was the cop that for the last 5 years of my drinking tried to put me away. But he had a defect of character and I knew what the defect was. He was honest. It's a weakness. You can get him sometimes. And because he could have had me 50 ways but once, but he had integrity. And he used to tell me, "I'm going to catch you straight up and you're going away for a long time, Ed." And I'd, "Everything's fair in love and war, chump." That's the guy I called. He picked up the phone, said, "Lieutenant Bob Garner." And I said, "Bob, this is Ed. My dad was in that tavern." I hadn't talked to Bob in 2.5 years. And he knew immediately who he was talking to. And he said, "Ed, hold on." He told me sometime later after that, he said, "I prayed for you that night." He said, "Because I knew if you could make it through this, you could make it through anything. I was really afraid you were going to go back to the old ways." And he kept me on the phone. The only thing we could come up with is my dad got shot and wandered outside or they took him hostage. So for the next 10, 12 hours, we searched the streets. And God, that's a horrible feeling. You know, all these searches that go on now. I was out in Oklahoma City 2 weeks ago and at the memorial there and all that searching. And I wouldn't pray that on anybody. I just wouldn't. About 10 o'clock the next morning, 8 o'clock, whatever it was, that officer from the hospital called up and said, "Well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. Why don't you come up and identify your old man?" So I got in my car and I went back up to the hospital. And I walked into that morgue and I saw my dad laying there on that metal table with a bullet hole in his face. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing. Came up with nothing. You see, I started out with kind and loving and forgiving. But then I started parroting what I heard in meetings. Oh, live and let live, day at a time. Easy does it. First things first. And I did little work on developing a relationship with God of my understanding. I developed one of your understanding. And I got to tell you, in that morgue that day, I was never more alone or afraid in my life. I was terrified. And I turned to walk to the door of the morgue, and I opened the door, and there was AA and Al-Anon standing out there. You see, I got a God that does for me what I cannot do for myself. And he surrounded me with people that would just took care of me. And everywhere I went, there was an AA or an Al-Anon for the next months. I remember going to the funeral. And it's kind of a funny story because Dad didn't like church much. The only time he'd go to church is when he drank up the check and was gone for 2-3 days. Then he'd go to church with Mom. But he didn't like church very much. And he had been sick about 6 months before. And in the hospital, really sick, and they thought he was going to die. And Dad got on the phone and called spiritual care and asked for somebody to come up and baptize him. "Well, you don't know my dad. That's amazing." And a Catholic priest come up named Father Grubb and baptized him, and they got to talking, and Dad really liked him. It's the only time he ever saw him. 6 months later, when my father was murdered, Mom said, you know, the only guy to do his funeral is Father Grubb. Because he really liked Father Grubb. Now, that's a lot for a Lutheran woman to tell. I'll tell you, you know. We called Father Grubb, and he did the funeral, and it was one of those I'll refer to this weekend as a God incident. Because he gave me one of the keys to the kingdom. While he was doing the funeral, I was a little annoyed at God. And he said, you know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will. He said, I don't believe that for a minute. He said, I believe God created all of us and gave us a free will. And some of God's children chose to do this act. And now it's God's will. It was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. You mean there's kids starving in the world because we're too busy up in our cell phone minutes instead of setting a few bucks? That's right. Don't blame God anymore. Cancer's rapid. Why? Because we pollute everything we touch and want to blame everybody else. Don't blame God anymore. When he gave it to us, it was pretty nice, if I read correctly. And I don't know about you, but that was just like the weight of the world. And I started believing then, and I believe more every day today. If it isn't good, it isn't God. Period. The God that I know and love would have nothing to do with those kind of incidences. Because if we're all his kids, we're all his kids. His kids were the perpetrators and the victims. He cried worse than all of us. I know I would if my son had done something like that, or my child. Shortly after that, God talked to me. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. Sponsorship's a very good thing. One of the very good things they do is they filter things. And they're good God filters. I remember one time I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, I got a message from God. And he said, oh, really, Ed? And I said, yeah, I did. He said, would you mind sharing it with me? I said, no, I'll share it with you. And I got all done. And he said, you know, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting. And I must tell you that's true, but I also got to tell you, pages 86, 87, and 88 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, by the way, tells anybody, regardless of what your ism is or was or however you say it, tells you how to live every second of every moment of every minute of every day, how to get up, how to go to bed, what to do if you're confused in between. 3 pages. And in that it says that I need to start relying upon inspiration. And what was once an occasional thought or action becomes a way of life. And I believe that today. I believe that God is with me everywhere I go because I ask him along. I ask him along. And right after that situation, God talked to me and said, Ed, go out to California, get into show business. I looked at my resume, made perfect sense to me. Got in my car, went to California where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy, yeah. Little did they know how well I fit the role. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor. I was goofy. And I never actually started that job. I ended up getting a sponsor by mistake. And I went up to this meeting in Los Angeles, and this guy was directing people here and directing people there. But there was an energy with these people. They were like alive. And no disrespect to anybody else, but I was used to going to meetings where you got to wake up people to give them a chip. You know, here, Ed, happy birthday. You know, and these folks were happening. They were alive, and they were doing things, and there was dancing, and there was just all kinds. And I just loved it, and I went up there the next week, and I asked this guy who seemed to be in charge. I said, excuse me, would you sponsor me? He said, no. And I said, why not? He said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. Ha, ha, ha. I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. That's what I need to hear. That's it. My favorite one is when it's always the same 2 questions by the same size person. First question is, oh, how tall are you? And I say 6'10". They say, oh, do you play basketball? I say, no, how tall are you? And they say 5'4". And I say, do you play miniature golf? Seems fair to me, you know. So he started with his tall joke, and I thought, this one's going in the tubes right now, you know. And he came up to me a few minutes later, and he said, I'll agree to be your sponsor, but you got to agree to do what I tell you to do. My name's Clancy. And I'm real grateful that I hadn't heard any of some of the stuff that goes around about him, true or not. because you would have killed me. I've heard some horrible things, and I would have never went and talked to anybody that way. And that if I'd heard it, it would have killed me. Because you see, Clancy was my Bill Wilson. Clancy was the one that sat me down and said, you know what, this will work for you, but you got to stop talking stuff and you got to start doing stuff. And about that time, I was introduced to Chuck Chamberlain. And I used to sit in Chuck's house, and Clancy'd be in one chair, and Chuck would be in his chair, and Clancy'd be over here. And Chuck would be saying, God is love, and love is God, and it's just that simple, kid. And Clancy'd be going, you got to have a sponsor, you got to do this, and you got to do that. And I'm going, God, they're both right. They're both right. You know? And I'm here to tell you, they're both right. You can't go all one way or one way. You know, if you're going to talk about faith, your actions speak so loud I can't hear a word you say. You know? And I love that. And he told me, he said, I want you to start all over on the steps. I said, well, I'm 2.5 years sober. I've been through the steps. I lecture on the steps. He said, well, obviously you got something wrong or you wouldn't be living in my garage. He had me there, so I went through the steps again. And I remember I started all over with God after Dad was killed. Because I want my faith to be my faith today. And it is. I've worked hard for it. I've searched hard. I've read hard. I've prayed hard. And the faith I have today is mine. But I started all over. My first honest prayer I believe I ever said is, God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so. You know, I sure hope so. And I started developing a relationship with God that I understood. And I was with Clancy for a while, and I'd been talking at things since I first got sober. I was a novelty act when I first got sober because I was 20, and people closest to me were 17 and 20 years older than me. So I started talking from a very early time in sobriety, and I got asked to speak in Pasadena, California, and I thought, ooh, Pasadena, wealthy area. I may go out there and hook up with a job, and I caught myself doing that hustle, and I stopped. And I got down on my knees and I said the same prayer I said in the hotel before I came over here tonight. I said, God, save me from my own nonsense. Let me just share the miracle you've performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want anything from these people. I've been overpaid. And I went and I talked at that meeting. Got done speaking at the meeting and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, this makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. Because one of the things you'll find out around these programs, once you surrender, it usually happens. And this guy said, have you ever been in Taiwan? I said, no. He said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. I went into his office in Century City, California on Monday morning. And we did that interview, and the producer said, well, what do you think? And I said, scares the heck out of me. He said, you're hired. And he saw the look on my face. He said, I've had dozens of people in here interviewing them, and they're saying, oh, no problem, no problem. He said, it scares me to death. I don't want some cocky young punk going over there pretending like he's going to be okay, because it isn't. It's all new territory for us. That was on Monday. On Thursday, I was lifting out of Los Angeles International Airport, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was new, soon-to-be vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 62 and a staff of 23. I went over to negotiate with the Taiwanese government, building the actual ice rink, the curtains, the stages, flying back and forth to Hong Kong with designer Bill Campbell, designed the costumes. How was your week? The Thursday before that, I was a gopher for a construction crew in Beverly Hills. I don't know how big your God is, but my God is a God that can change things like that. One difference. I need to go when he does. A lot of us like to stay in what's familiar. You know, stay in that craziness. Stay in that discomfort, that dis-ease, because at least it's familiar. And if you got a God like mine, he's going to give you opportunities, but you got to walk. And you know, the only reason I could walk is the people in AA talked me into dropping that bag of ones I'd collected about every area of my life. You're white trash, Ed. You're never going to be anything. You're going to be dead or in prison by the time you're 21. You aren't anything, and you're not too bright. You told me I could do anything I wanted to do, and I challenge you to prove you wrong. And here I am getting off a plane in Taipei, Taiwan, and everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me like I'm looking at them, you know. And then it's just a matter of time before they tie me down. And I was there for a while, and I had a wonderful time. I won't go into a lot of that tonight because I just don't have time. But I'll tell you what I learned over there. I learned that I have gifts and talents that I would have never believed I possessed unless I saw me do them. People all my life said, Ed, you have so much potential. You have so much potential. Guess what? They've always been right, and you're still wrong. They've always been right. I hardly ever, can't consciously think of one, but there's had to be one, met a person in these rooms that aren't blessed beyond their own understanding. Wildly beyond their own understanding. And I'm sitting there negotiating contracts with a full-time interpreter. I'd been kicked out of school when I was in seventh grade, and I hadn't paid attention 2 years before that. You know, I didn't have a spiffy resume. In fact, I was in Kaohsiung, and a guy walked by me and said, you know, Ed, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, sure. Got home to Los Angeles 3 months later, got a call from the Harlem Globetrotters. They said, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come up and talk to us? And I said, I'd be honored to. And I was honored to. You know why? You told me I had the right to be here. You told me I had the right to achieve and experience any goodness that's in this life. The only one that can deny it from me is me. Oh, and I did for a long time. Went in there. Handed that president my resume. He crumpled it up and threw it in the trash. He said, I can pay some chump $75 to put down a lot of nice things about me. I'm hiring you. Talk to me. And we talked, and a few hours later, I walked out of there the new manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. There was only one time in my home when I remember happiness together and celebration. It happened about this time of the year, a little earlier in the month. It was on Wide World of Sports. Dad would be sober. It'd be a Sunday afternoon. Mom would be popping popcorn. And all the kids would be gathered around, and Dad would be sitting right there, and this basketball team would come on TV. And they'd be whistling this song and whipping that ball around. And there's this guy named Metalark that had just had my dad rolling on the floor. It's the only happy memory I have of a family. Imagine how it felt 8 years sober. Just 8 years sober. 8 years before I'm laying in the middle of the street pretending like I'm knocked out. Seventh grade education. All the odds against me. 8 years later, I'm giving Metalark Lemon the high sign to start the warm-up circle in Madison Square Garden. Are these extravagant promises? I think not. But there's a difference. You got to walk toward them. I ran away from a few, from wonderful opportunities. Because, oh, I thought people like me can't do that, or it's scary, or it's this or that. But faith is walking through scary things, you know. Faith is walking through things that just terrify you. It's like courage. I hear people all the time, you know, they say, oh, courage is, well, I'll go out there and I'll do this and I'll do that. And it's, The comparison I always think of is in war when your buddy gets shot out there. People think, well, that's Fred. I'm going to go out there and save my buddy. Hasn't been what I understand. What I hear is, oh, my God, Fred shot. I'm scared to death, but he's my buddy. I'm going to go try to save him. And he goes. It's the same with faith. I don't know. It scares me to death. But I'm going to go. I'm going to go. Same thing. Different understanding. Different understanding. And I had a great time. I went all over the world. Been around the world 3 times and met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador to London. She was Muslim, wealthy, beautiful. Well, our backgrounds are a lot alike. This should work, you know. And we got married, and it didn't work out too well because I was sadly mistaken. I thought she married me because I was manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. She wasn't nearly that shallow. She saw a guy that she dearly loved, and he didn't know how to accept it. So I ruined that marriage. We didn't ruin that marriage. I ruined that marriage, and I'm not telling you that braggadocio. I just got to share the truth with you, otherwise this weekend's going to be a waste. And I also can tell you that today we're good friends. And those three kids that wouldn't talk to me for years now talk to me. You know? There isn't a thing in your life that's strained that can't be bettered. When I was 17, I ran into a girl with a bad reputation. Those are the ones I liked. And you don't have to risk rejection. That's really good. And we got together and a baby happened. Somehow I found out later how that happened. Tried to stay away from that after that, but it didn't help much. And we had a baby. And I was about 6 months sober. Maybe a year sober. And she came to me and she said, "You know, Ed, you're pretty worthless. Nobody thinks you're going to stay sober." And I'm going, "Well, yeah, that's true. Me either." Said, "You know, the only bright spot in your life is Jamie, your son. Why don't you just leave us alone?" I had his name tattooed and burnt Bible pages in my arm when I was in county jail doing 30 days for assault and battery on some guy that thought he was tough. And I agreed with her. I said, "You know what? You're probably right. If I really love him, I'll probably just stay away from him." And a lot of things went on. Needless to say, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, he was on my front porch spitting in my face telling me he was going to kill me. And he's about 6'5", and he's an iron worker. And I got up with him nose to nose and I said, "Son, do what you got to do. If it's going to make you feel better, do what you got to do." And he walked away and he said I was crazy. And I wasn't crazy. I'd do anything to help him heal. Anything to help him heal. He called me back the next day and apologized for the things he'd said. I got a new sponsor about a year ago. And he said, "Ed, I want you to look at your amends list and see what you haven't done." And I'm thinking, "You know, Tom, I'm sober 36 years. I doubt if there's a whole lot I haven't." I wasn't telling him this. I was thinking this. There's probably a whole lot I haven't done about that, but I'll amuse you and I'll look. First one that came up on my amends list was my 24-year-old son that asked me to come out and be badged. Had I not visited that list, I would have never been asked. Because what I realized is I needed to make a better, more concerted effort to stay in touch with him. Second one to come up on that list was that young man I fathered when I was 17, or whatever I was, 16, 17. And I didn't know how to do that except because I'd apologized for years. I'd tried to make amends for years. And he just hated me. He just hated me. His mother told him a lot of horrible, rotten things. And about 15 years ago, she sat him down and said, "I need to tell you, that isn't true." But he got too used to being angry. Not that we'd ever do something like that, but he got too used to being angry, so he just preferred to stay angry. And he did a good job of it. And about a year ago, year and a half maybe, I made a 12-step call on a young man. And I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of doing that, making a 12-step call on somebody and all of a sudden the light comes on and you know that their life has changed from that moment on. It's a gift from God. And it just clicked. I can do this. I can. And I'm driving home and I'm thinking about my son Mike. He changed his name from Jamie to Mike because he was named after me and my middle name's James. Some people say, "Well, you changed his name," and I never tell you why. That's why. I called Mike and I said, "Mike," he picked up the phone. I said, "Mike, this is Ed." And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I just want to tell you, buddy, I am so sorry about some of the decisions I made in fatherhood." And I told him about the experience he had. And I said, "I can't tell you how much I missed being a part of your life and being there with you." And he said to me, he got silent. And he said to me, "You'll never know how much that means to me." I had said that same thing to him many, many times. But my old friend Chuck C. used to say something that's very important. You can't see till you can see, and you can't hear till you can hear. And for some reason, at that moment, in that space and time, he heard me. A few months later, his father-in-law died. And God said, Ed, send some flowers. So I sent some flowers. And he called his mother the day after the funeral, and he said, I don't know about Ed. The guy I called Dad didn't even give me a phone call, and the guy I've been cursing for 30 years sent flowers. He said, maybe I got Ed wrong. She said, I've told you for years you've had him wrong. And he said, well, maybe I'll call and ask him to lunch. She called and shared that with me, and that's all I needed. I didn't need the lunch because I try to live without expectations anymore. I was just so excited he'd even think of that. 4 months later, he called me up and said, you want to go to lunch? I said, I'd love to go to lunch. We sat down at lunch. He said, I want to tell you something. You're never going to see my kids. I don't even know why I'm sitting here. I just figured I better talk to you and get this over with. I said, okay. And 2.5 hours later, he's showing me pictures of the kids and telling me. Because when he said that to me, I just said, Mike, I'm honored that I'm sitting here with you. I'm honored that I'm sitting here with you. 2 months later, he called and said, you want to go to lunch again? I said, yeah. Oh, I'd love to. And I'm going up to go to lunch, and I see this little girl with just ringlets in her hair by the crane over here. I'd never seen her before. Saw a picture, that quick picture, and that was Bailey, my little granddaughter, who's 5, that I never thought I'd ever see. And you know, the communications is that we have today, I just love. I just walked in and I looked at him. I said, thank you. He said, don't mention it. I didn't give it a second thought. And she didn't call me Grandpa. And I didn't tell her who I was. But you know what? When we walked out of that restaurant, I heard that little girl say to her daddy, Daddy, that's a nice man. That's a very nice man. And I heard my son say to my daughter, yes, honey, he is. There is always hope. Don't give up hope. There may be damaged relationships, but don't give up hope. Don't. Be ready. Be ready and willing. At 18 years sober, I made some decisions. What time is it? How are we doing on time? Okay, good. Huh?
We got lots of CDs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, don't worry, I'm going to quit around 1 no matter what. But no, I'm almost done here. But I lost everything I owned. And I don't blame that on anything. God is not testing me. I hate it when people say, God's testing me. That's right, he stops the whole world just to goof around with your day. That's right. Oh, there's Ralph down there. Yeah. No ego there, no self-centeredness there. Yeah, jeez. But God didn't test me. I made all the wrong decisions. I didn't pray about it. I didn't ask God. I didn't ask my sponsor about it. I didn't ask anybody. They offered me this deal. It was $14,000 a month. And that was pretty good money back then. Probably still is. And I made the deal. Cost me $30,000-$40,000 to get in. Done. And within 6 months, they got personal. They came and took the Mercedes and kicked me out of my Burbank apartment right down by NBC Studios. And 18 years sober, I'm as broke as you can get. And for the first time in my sobriety, I couldn't get something together. I could always get something together. Nothing. I'd do things like I'd get a job and I'd go to work and be reporting for work the first day. I'd been in sales and motivation and a lot of different things after I left the Globetrotters and with Metal Arc's new team and was in sales. I could always get something going. And I go into somebody who just hired me. I remember one guy was hired as a sales manager. And I'm walking in to start my first day on the job, and the general manager's coming out the door and said, Ed, I don't know what to tell you. They just fired me. Stuff like that was happening time and time and time again. There again, God isn't testing me, but this world will test my faith. And I don't know if that means much to you, but that's a big difference for me. I don't want a God that's a game player. I don't want a God that's going to play little psychological games to get my attention. That's why I didn't like it in the first place. And I one day I thought, well, I'm going back to Iowa. It's where my home was, and I went back there. And I absolutely love it there. Been back there since 1988 after 17 years in Los Angeles, traveling all over the world. I have a house out in the middle of the country. I live in between two small towns, population 200 apiece. And they're 5 miles apart, and I live at the 2.5-mile marker. My nearest neighbor's a quarter mile away. People say, "Don't you get lonely out there?" I say, "Call before you come." I love it. Absolutely love it. Wouldn't trade it for the world. But one of the things I like about the Midwest is, for the most part, people are honest here. So much more than on the coast. That's been my experience. And that there's hard-working people here. And I like them. And I'm one of them, hopefully. I was home a little while, and I decided to quit smoking. There's fun. And I went to the doctor when I quit smoking. He said, "Well, Eddie," said, "I think you should start running and get some exercise." So I started jogging and broke my leg. If you're over 300 pounds, don't jog. Trust me. It's not a good thing. But I quit smoking, and that's fine. And I use the same 12 steps. They'll work with anything I actually use them on. It's just amazing. And one day I'm sitting there in the house, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I got a little apartment house, and I'm back on my feet. It's 1992, and things are working out pretty good. And God talks to me again. He said, "Ed, get an education." And I did what any self-respecting, non-educated alcoholic would do. I went, "La, la, 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 la." He calls right back. It doesn't matter. I get on my crutches, and I hobble over to the university over there, and I said, "Excuse me, I'd like to go to school." And they said, "How many credits do you have?" And I said, "I have bad credits. Why? What's that got to do with anything?" And they laughed like you did, and I said, "No, you need to please hear me. This is I treasure this gift." I said, "You don't seem to understand. I don't know if I'm smart enough to pass a class, but I'd like to try to go to school. I've always been afraid I'm too dumb. Got kicked out of school in seventh grade, hadn't studied 2 years before that. Would you help me?" In 3 weeks, I was in the university. When I was out in Los Angeles, I was dating a gal who graduated from Vassar, which is a very nice woman's school, and I believe it's New York. She was always annoyed that I didn't have a high school education. So one day I'm reading the LA Times, and I see that at UCLA they're giving out GED tests, $50. So I zip up there and get her high school education. Take the little test, and 6 weeks later, here I am, high school graduate. There, you feel better now? Thing that I never told anybody is I cried when I opened that mailbox. I never thought I could do that. I did it to prove I couldn't. That's what got me into the university. Because at that time in Southern California, you had to be in the top 2% of the class of that year to get a GED. And 3 weeks later, I'm in it. And you won't believe this, because if you've ever worked with the government, you know that nothing comes easy. One phone call to the state of California, I had no idea how to get that. One phone call to the state of California got me my GED in my mailbox in 2 days. Now, you don't tell me there ain't a God, you know, because it takes 6 weeks just to get an answer, you know. And I started going to school, and I loved it. I was in there with 18 and 19-year-olds, and I didn't experientialize out of anything. I didn't clep out of anything. I took every single class. And I was going for communications, and I got in about 60 hours and started working for the university, and I never missed a commitment or an AA meeting that I was supposed to be at. So I'm the wrong guy to tell you don't have time, because I'm one of those that believe if you want to do it, God will make time. At least that's been my experience. And about 2 years into doing that, I went on a Christian retreat, and I had a spiritual awakening very similar to what Bill had. And it changed my life from that moment to this. And God said to me, "I want you to work for me, and I want you to help my kids." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I've never looked back. I left that retreat, and I joined the Methodist Church. I had within 3 weeks, I was doing services in the church. I said, can't be that hard, you know. They got to print it out here. And I went and I talked to them, and I said, what do you got to do to stay here? And I said, you got to get your BA, and then you got to get your little 96-hour master's degree. Isn't that amazing? You can be an attorney with 30 hours. You can have an MBA with 30 hours. To have a master's of divinity, you need 96 hours. And that's what I did, 1 hour at a time. And a short 6 years later, I was all done. And I tell that to you, not braggadocio. I tell that to you that anything's possible. I'd never done anything except stay sober that long before. And I was one of those that always told you I hated school, and I realized that was a lie. It was just convenient to my argument of why I wasn't there. The truth was I was terrified of school. I didn't think I was smart enough. And I became a pastor, and I've never stopped going to AA, never will, one day at a time, because this is where I found God, and I don't ever want to forget that. And I was in the Methodist Church for 8 years, and they got in a new bishop, and they said, he said, I hear you go talk in AA once a month. One Sunday a month, you're gone, speaking somewhere. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you need to make a decision then. You can either be with our church or you can go speak in your AA conferences. Well, I'm here. And it wasn't an easy decision because I found out there's a lot of 299s in life, not just in AA. And everywhere I go, in church, in Walmart, everywhere I want to look for goodness, I find it. All depends on what I'm looking for, because I always find it. And that was tough. It wasn't tough in one sense, because I knew I owed you. I owed it to carry this message, like I said today, sitting in that gatehouse, realizing my job is to continue the conversation. That's all my job is. I'm not a big deal. I just need to continue the conversation. And they had a roast for me. And there was 450 people showed up at the roast. And nobody'd say anything bad about me. One person got up and said, we don't even jokingly want to say anything bad about Pastor Ed. We just want him to know that we love him and we were glad he was pastor of our church for this last 4 years. And that what he does in AA and he will always be in our prayers. And we thank him for spending our life with us. His life with us. And that was 6 miles from 6th and LeClaire, where I laid in the middle of the street. And I knew life was over. I was done. Shortly before I left the church, I was preaching on forgiveness one day. And I always try to, I tell speakers in AA to give them heaven. They've had enough of the other stuff. So I always try to share my experience, strength, and hope with whatever's going on. And I was sharing on forgiveness that day, and I realized I stopped, and I said, you know what, I can't talk about forgiveness because I haven't told the guys who killed my father that they were forgiven a long time ago. And it's just like the eighth step. You can forgive them in your heart all you want, but if you didn't go do it, then it's self-serving. You didn't rectify anything except your own mood. And I said, I will not preach on forgiveness. I stopped right there and said, we'll not preach on forgiveness till all of them know. 2.5 weeks later, a God incident happened. One of the guy's sentence was overturned. And the press came to me in the Quad Cities and said, Pastor Ed, what do you think? And I said, well, let him come home. It's time to start over. It's time to start fresh. And they said, well, he went in there when he was 17. He's been in there 27 and a half years. He doesn't have a career. He doesn't know where's he going to work, where's he going to live. And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like. And they were taken back by that. And I'm not sure why. You allowed me in here. What did he do that I wasn't capable of with the right substances or the wrong situation? Who am I not to open my house to him? You invited me into your homes. You introduced me to your children. You told me I had a right to be here, that I'm a human being, and more importantly, that I'm a good human being. How can I deprive him of exactly what you gave me? And that story went all over the world. It was on the front page of the LA Times, London Times, New 2020 was calling me, Oprah called me, everybody called me and said, well, how could you do that? And I said, well, it's the eighth step. You know, if you're really working eight, and they didn't get it. They didn't understand any of that. But as God would have it, a few weeks later, I was walking into a prison. It was a prison I swore I'd never go in ever again, because I spent my youth going in that prison, seeing my brother every 30 days. And I couldn't stand the clanging of those doors, because when I was young, it was because I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life hearing them, if I lived. And I'm walking in that prison. And I walked down a hall and into a cell to a guy that 27 and a half years before that, I was in a courtroom testifying against him. And my thought when I walked in is, give me 5 minutes and we won't need a trial. But AA had ruined me. You told me that I might be the only example of AA they may ever see, so I needed to behave myself and just answer the questions. And that's what I did. 27 and a half years later, I walk into that cell and see that guy. And I stick out my hand and I say, Sherman, my name's Ed Mutum. And I'm here to tell you that I love you and I forgive you. And I believe God loves you and I forgive you, and I only have one request. And he said, what's that? And I said, if there's anything I can ever do to add to your life, allow me to do that. I made a friend that day. I hadn't planned on that. I just knew what I needed to do. And God blessed me with a friend. And they were going to retry him. And in the state of Iowa, if you're with somebody in the act of a felony with a gun, you serve life. And by his own testimony, he was there. And I was moved to go down and talk to the county attorney and ask him to give my friend a break. He said, Eddie's just trying to con you and to get him out. And I said, he don't even know I'm here. This is my idea. I was praying the other day and God said, get him out, Eddie. And I went down, and that county prosecutor who used to spend the time putting me away listened to me. And they let him plead to second-degree murder. And he had to serve another year and a half to complete 30 years. And then he could be discharged. So that's what he did. And I got to go up to prison. I got to pick him up, the man who murdered my father. And I got to bring him into my home. And I got to give him a key to the house. And I got to go get him some clothes. And I got to go with him on jobs. Because when he'd say, what were you convicted of? Felony murder. I could say, look, I'm one of the victim's relatives and we support him. We're here. And they'd give him a job, but it wouldn't last long. Because when you've been in maximum security since you were 17 years old, it scars you up a bit. And he's still free. I haven't talked to him in a long time. He met a little blonde girl, and I haven't seen him since. And I understand that as well. So that's why this weekend we're going to talk about forgiveness, and we're going to talk about healing. I'm not trying to talk to you where I haven't been. I'm just trying to show you where you took me and how you took me there. I'm pleased to be here. The Methodist Church has just asked me back into its fold. I don't know if I'm going because I have my own little church and God's got a deal. He'll take care of me and I'll try to build a church for him. And I have a church that don't tell you how to think. I welcome you to think anything you want. And I only ask one thing. Don't profess a faith you don't have. Your life is too important. Be right where you're at and grow from there. Because you know what? That's the only place we can grow from is where we're at. Lying about it and wishing this and wishing that and being negative about this and negative about that, that isn't going to do a thing except destroy us from the inside out. That spiritual malady, which means spiritual disease, is alive and well in our rooms. It's more than just putting the plug in the jug. It's more than just releasing with love. It's a way of life. And hopefully you'll be here tomorrow to share that. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Dave.